Morning. According to my notes, there are students from Wayland Academy. Would they please rise? Would you stand up? A hearty welcome to all of you. Won't you be seated? And there are students from Hayward. Would they stand up, please? It's a long ride. Well, welcome to the Supreme Court Chambers to you also. Won't you be seated? Now that the court has had an opportunity to meet our students who are here with our court with class program, I would like to introduce the court to the students who are with us, as well as others present in the courtroom. And I will start on my far left, your right, and after Justice Patrick Cook. To his right is Justice Janine Gueske, and to her right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. And to his right is Justice John Wilcox. And to the father's right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Now that the introductions are done, the other thing I want to say to those participating with the court, with class, that after the oral argument, Justice John Wilcox will come back into the courtroom and speak with you about the Supreme Court processes and answer any questions you have. I will call the first case for this morning, which is 96-1775 CR, State v. Huntington. Mr. Sarr, you represent the defendant, Mr. Huntington.
Chief Justice Abramson, Honorable Justices, Jack Shire, Assistant State Public Defender, representing the defendant, appellant petitioner in this case, Eugene Huntington. The first issue before this court is the standard for admission of excited utterance testimony where there is a child victim of sexual assault. This court, in a number of cases which have been footnoted and described in State versus Gerald L.C., 194 Whiff Second, a court of appeals case, has basically held that there should be an exciting event. And in fact, the time frame is not necessarily determinative. What is determinative is the duration of the exciting event, whether the person is still under that stress. The court, Gerald L.C., conducted a survey and came up with three factors. That is, whether, in fact, the child was under 10 years old, that whether, in fact, it was less than a week before the reporting of this incident, and whether it was to her mother. I submit that this is an accurate survey of the case law to be consistent with cases from this court and the theories behind the excited utterance exception. I would suggest, however, that this court is the state's highest court in policymaking and law-determining court. Would not necessarily have to take a mechanistic formula governing all cases. I think it was clear from Gerald L.C. that there should be some flexibility, obviously, as to other factors. One thing I have pointed out with regard to the residual exception, and I think it would apply here, is in the context of Idaho versus Wright, which is a United States Supreme Court case dealing with confrontation clause and the admission of hearsay statements of a child sexual assault victim under the residual exception, had identified four factors that they thought were particularly relevant from their survey of state and federal law to the truthfulness of child sexual assault victims. One of those had to do with spontaneity and consistency of statements. A second factor had to do with the mental state of the child. A third was citing our own Sorensen case for the factor of whether there was a use of language which was inconsistent with the child of that particular age. And fourth, whether the child had a motive to fabricate. It would be our position in this case that none of the factors identified in Gerald L.C. Were met. We had a situation here where this child had apparently spoken to her cousin Natasha sometime in the summer. Was unspecified. She had spoken to Geraldine's aunt at an unspecified time. There was no showing that under any of these circumstances that there was any particular stress or emotion, nor during the period before her speaking with her mother on the 19th of August of 1994. There was also some...
Well, this youngster testified?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why did they bring in all the hearsay?
Your Honor, I think that this is an important question because it would be our position that this evidence was piling on, it was cumulative, and it would be unnecessary. The most important factor was the evidence that the child herself could give. She testified and was subject to cross-examination.
Did it conflict with the hearsay testimony?
In several respects. The child was unable to pin down precisely when the time frame for these assaults in her testimony. Also, she was not able to really be specific as to the number of these assaults. And to the people that she had spoken to, Officer Glau, who's an officer with the Schuyler Police Department, she had told him, it's reflected on one page of his report, that it was January 94, another June of 94, when in terms of time frame when this was over. She had also told her mother that it was August of 94, and there were different numbers. Officer Glau, I believe it was 6 to 8 incidents, her mother 20 to 25, and a tribal counselor 40 to 60. So there was obviously a serious difference in terms of what
I could ask you a couple of things about the record. Were the rulings on the admissibility of these hearsay statements, were they all made in motions in limine, or were some made during the course of the trial?
What happened is there was a motion in limine filed by the defense attorney and responded to by the state. And this was heard.
And the motion in limine by the defense was to exclude all the hearsay statements?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, what happened is the trial judge, prior to trial, ruled that these statements, without citing case law, but law from this court, generally that there was an expansive view of admission of this testimony in child sexual assault cases, allowed it in as an excited utterance. The issue was joined and was argued as to the residual exception, but it was never decided. The defense lawyer made a continuing objection. He said,
Procedurally, did this happen before opening statements or after?
Before.
Okay, so the defense lawyer knew at opening statements that these hearsay statements were coming in.
That's correct.
And so I assume that's why you're going to say the defense lawyer raised some of those statements in terms of what he said during the opening statement.
Our position, the state has argued that under the rule of completeness that the door was open. We submit that this would be grossly unfair. It is not what the rule of completeness really...
You already had that ruling by the trial court that those statements were going to go in.
That's correct.
And the cross-examination of the victim when she testified involved asking her about all these statements, but again, that was the defense lawyer already knew they were coming in. Is that right?
Yes.
What was the, and I've not read the closing arguments, what was the theory of the defense in this case in terms of defense?
The theory of the defense in this case was that the defendant, Eugene Huntington, who had testified that he did not do any of these things, did not commit these crimes. This was not correct.
That she fabricated it, and was it an improper motive or undue influence, or what was the theory of why this child testified that she had been sexually assaulted by him?
It was not completely understood by the defense what this was. In terms of the examination of the defendant, it was brought up that the parents had been going through a separation, and also that he had been seeing a new girlfriend, and the suggestion was that this could have been
something which involved a motive.
Let me ask you one more question while we're on this, and I'll let you get back to the structure of your argument. Why are those statements not admissible as prior consistent statements of the victim to rebut an inference of undue influence or improper motive?
Well, I think that you can see in the closing argument.
I see the state of making that argument.
No, they aren't. In the closing argument, this is true. The defense attorney was not arguing that this was undue influence or something on these people. In other words, that they believed that they were true. And there was
That's not why it's admissible. If it were admissible, it would be that there's an argument that the victim is making this up, that there's been, that there's a recent fabrication, or there's undue influence by a parent, or...
No.
And I'm just trying to get this in the context, for me, why they would not be admissible under one of those theories.
It seems to me that, first of all, there's an argument. This was not an argument that was raised by the state at trial.
No, and they're not raising it here, and I'm sure the state will tell me why. But it bothered me when I was reading the brief, so I just...
Would it be our position that that any argument on that level would have been waived? The question is, there were inconsistencies in these statements, as I've outlined briefly, with regard to numbers of incidents, when they occur, etc. The general tenor. So there's a question about whether these are consistent or not consistent. And that could have been argued in the trial court and was
not.
Yeah,
but the offense is it never happened.
That's
so
correct.
In that sense, it's consistent. If the argument was you got the wrong date, you know, you've charged these dates and actually it happened on those dates.
That wasn't it.
Okay.
So those inconsistent statements would be good for you. If your defense is it didn't happen, it shows that she's making it up, or you can infer that she's making it up and that she's not remembering what she told or to whom.
Well, one of the things that, Your Honor, that this court is going to have to consider as the policymaking court for the state is whether there's any definition beyond what GLC talks about in terms of the formula reflecting case law.
Mr. Shire, you had mentioned earlier that you didn't feel that any of the factors in Gerald L.C. were met in this particular case. However, isn't it very clear from that decision by the Court of Appeals that while they're setting forth three factors, they're saying those factors are not necessarily dispositive?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I agree with that. And I'm saying that one of the challenges before this court is what other considerations might trial judges and litigants be using in terms of these things. And what some of the considerations that have been mentioned in the Idaho versus Wright would be things that would certainly bear on spontaneity and would be something I think that certainly could be
considered.
Could
you take us through the record and tell us why, in your estimation, these were not excited utterances? What about, you know, the time lapse, the nature of the interview, her condition between the time of the alleged incidents and the statements? What is it that because this is a discretionary call by the trial court for the most part, right?
Yes.
And so tell us what you think is in this record that would show us that this was either an erroneous exercise of discretion or even as a matter of law because of some factors that would keep this out of the hearsay exception.
Your Honor, first of all, there is a question as to when, in fact, the last incident was. I think there's an argument that it's either in June of 94 or in August of 94, 2 weeks before. Assuming it was August 94, there's no showing that she was, of anything that happened in that two-week period, which would show that she was under stress of this exciting event. At least that's our position. It's also important to note that in this particular
case... Mr. Shire, can I just interrupt you for a minute there? When you're looking at whether or not a person is, especially a child, is under the stress of the event, it's my understanding from the case law that you look at the emotional state as the child is relating the situation. Now, doesn't the record here reflect from the testimony that the child was almost hysterical when the child was reciting these things to her mother?
That's correct, Your Honor. At that particular time, the record reflects that the mother was crying and the child was crying. And then the sister, Dawn Bearhart, came into the room and observed them both crying. The question is, does this crying and emotion so long after the event necessarily show stress of the exciting event throughout a period which could have been from June 94, but or even from August 94, assuming that it was August 94, when there's no other circumstances. We say that it does not. And there's more, I think you have to take this,
Here, Mr. Scheer, and I want you to get back to answering Justice Geske's,
yes.
But I want to follow up Justice Crooks's, which is responsible.
Sure.
Are you saying that in order for a statement to qualify as an excited utterance, there must be a continuity of stress? What if that stress is interrupted? What if the child has, goes to Disneyland for 3 days and gets her mind completely off that, but then comes back and is reminded of the event and gets all excited again?
Your Honor, no, I'm not saying it has to be a continuity. I think the absence, and this was noted in Gerald L.C., the absence of the evidence of stress during that period, which is something that a court would have to consider. I'll give you an example. Let's say a child was in a catatonic state for a period of time. Could be a month. And all of a sudden spoke. And the obvious source of this state had been this particular incident or series of incidents. It seems to me that a court could certainly find under those circumstances that this had been the stress of the exciting event that caused this, and that this would be sufficiently temporally related to be admissible and trustworthy. But I think it's a factor. I think you have to look at it. And I think you have to look at it in the context of other things. Now, she had told a cousin, Natasha, sometime in the summer about these incidents. And she had told Jacqueline's aunt about these incidents. Now, one thing I did not mention in my brief, and I just saw in terms of preparing for this argument, apparently at page 228 of the record, there's a reference to discussion with social worker Mosier 2 weeks before she told her mother. But the question is, none of these people testified. There's no suggestion from any source from the state side that she was under great emotional stress or distress when she talked to these people, or that she was under any fear or threat. She was asked directly if Mr. Huntington had threatened her, and she said no. And she was asked why she didn't tell, and she said he gave me great stuff. Apparently, the state's theory was that he had bought her all these goods of one type or another, and that was what induced this matter to continue. But it seems to me, Your Honor, that the excited utterance exception has definite limits, and the limits that have been recognized in Gerald L.C. from a survey of the case law of this court and the Court of Appeals seems to me to at least show that, in fact, the factors relating to an excited utterance have not been met, and there has been no real showing or compelling showing that she would have been under the stress of exciting events.
Now, counsel, just in Gerald L.C., we're dealing with a 14-year-old girl. Here you're dealing with basically one who's 4 years younger. Certainly,
yes.
Just address that age factor, because I think that as we look at the case law, we know that where you have younger children, there is more leeway, so to speak, as far as the time factor for excited utterance. And we have cases that go back to 15 days when you're dealing with a 5-year-old.
That's correct.
And basically, we're dealing with a 10-year-old, although she became 11, I guess, just at the time of the disclosure.
Her birthday was, I believe, in 1993. Your Honor, I think that the difference would have to do with the sense that somebody of this age, certainly somebody who is not a small child. I'm not talking about a 3 or 4 or 5 year old child, or somebody whose ability to communicate and understanding of perhaps matters of the sexual nature is almost unknown or very limited. I think that that's really quite different. I think when you have somebody who's 11, 14, I can't say that that difference, as an abstract, is significant in every case. But I think the younger you get, I think it's a fair thing to say, a fair thing for a trial judge to say, looking at that, that would be younger than in some of the cases where the courts have found that the excited utterance didn't apply.
Isn't the foundation for the trustworthiness of the excited utterance is that there's no time for reflection.
Absolutely.
That there's not a gap in time when you can either be influenced or think about it or change it, even though you may later be excited about it, that it's the incident that has so excited you that while you're still under that excitement, you're not thinking about it, and you just, it's not as spontaneous because there can be a period of time, but you're still talking from the stress of the particular incident.
That's correct. In fact, the United States Supreme Court in Idaho versus Wright, which I have described as being a higher bar case that involved a confrontation clause, but basically stated that the rationale for the excited utterance exception is that there is not time for confabulation or coaching or for fabrication. And that's the whole theory is that it's admissible whether or not there's cross-examination because it is so trustworthy.
To go back to we started with, you know, the time lapse, and I'd like you to go through the other factors you think exist here. So, you could. You were going to go through a list for me of things, the record that you think shows either there was an erroneous exercise of the judge's discretion or an erroneous ruling by the judge in a finding that this was an excited utterance.
Right. I think that one of the things is that would have to be considered, and I mentioned it in response to Judge Crook's question, I believe, is the fact that when she did talk to her mother, there was emotion on both sides. It's not totally clear all of the circumstances of that situation. I also think it's important, and I mentioned, I believe, also that she had a motive to fabricate because of the marital status and also the new girlfriend of the stepfather. Her own mental state was such that she became very emotional at this particular time, but had not been when speaking to others or in the entire course subsequent to the conclusion of these incidents that were alleged to have occurred. And so it's our position that this stretches the meaning of the excited utterance exception far beyond anything that was contemplated. I think it's...
Counsel, in looking at Professor Blinker's book, discussing the Sorensen case, he points to three factors that this court used to extend the excited utterance even months beyond the event. He says, the court reasoned that even where the victim reported the assault months after the event itself, the number one, the nature of the assault, and number two, the pain of reporting it, and number three, especially when the offender was a member of the family, those three things provided a sufficient basis for concluding that the declarant was still under the stress or excitement caused by the event. Do you agree with Professor Blinka's characterization of our law?
Your Honor, I think that the characterization sets a very extreme example, and I believe that it does not adequately reflect what the excited utterance exception really means as interpreted by this court. And
does it accurately reflect what this court said in Sorensen? That's what he was characterizing.
I think what this court said in Sorensen is that there is a temporal time, and Sorensen was a very limited time frame. The court made clear that there's a very liberal interpretation. There is an interpretation that is based upon it's very expansive. But I think what that means in terms of months and things like this gets away from the real stress of the incident. And I think it, as a bottom line, has to be under the stress of the exciting event. And as the characterization, as I understand it, as you have read, I don't believe adequately reflects that.
Why is it that when the child for the first time tells the mother, not any discussion of these events before, tells the mother what took place, she's got feelings of guilt, shame, even though they're not deserved, that she tells what the events were, but that isn't an excited utterance?
Your Honor, I think It is one of those situations where the whole purpose of the excited utterance rule, as I've explained to Justice Geske, involves the lack of opportunity and time for fabrication, confabulation, or coaching. And in fact, if you can show that she is still under, or has been under the stress of the exciting event, I think it's significant. Here there was no finding by Judge Winton that she was. He just simply said, as a matter, that there's been an expansive interpretation by this court, and it comes in. And I think that basically, another factor is the courts have looked, and I would like to, I'm in the yellow light, so I'm trying to get at this. One of the things that has also been discussed in these cases, and is discussed in Gerald L. C., and refers to Sorensen, is that the residual exception under 908.03.24 can be used for the admission of excited utterance matters. One thing I think is important, and Sorensen says this, and this is discussed in the context, we have to realize that Judge Winton didn't address the residual exception in his ruling, okay? And in fact, this didn't come out. But during trial, and this is mentioned just in my discussion in the brief of the various Sorensen factors, because this court could rely on the residual exception. Sorensen said that the residual exception can be used in a child sexual assault case. There's a compelling reason for its use where there's a one-on-one. They're alone. Now, at page 213 and 214 of the record of the trial, there was a suggestion that sometimes friends were there. Now, this was just argued in terms of one of the factors in the brief, and it's not disqualifying, perhaps erroneously by myself. I'm in the red light. Can I continue? And there's a question here. If Sorensen continues to be applied by this court, whether in fact this evidence would come in at all under the residual exception or how it would, was not sorted out in the trial court. And if this case goes back to the trial court, it seems to me that that's something would have to be looked at very carefully.
I have two questions. One that you've been trying to say here, namely, I don't hear you wanting to reverse or overturn Gerald, the case, but you keep trying to tell us, I hear, that we make the policy, and what is it exactly you would want this court to say as to excited utterance? That's my first question. Whether you agree with Gerald, I'll see that, but the fact is it's set forth. My second question is, we've spent all your time on excited utterance, which may be all right. There are several other evidentiary issues in this case. And it would seem to me that you'd have to have prejudicial error here in order to reverse the conviction. And can you stand just on excited utterance being the error without the others? So what's your first one? What's the policy issue you've been trying to tell us?
I believe that Gerald L. C. Accurately states the rulings of this court and the Court of Appeals and the policy behind them. To the extent that other factors can be considered, I would ask that this court consider those as particularly probative of truthfulness referred to by the U.S. Supreme Court in Idaho versus Wright. In terms of the second question had to do with these other factors that we have not had a chance to discuss. It's my position that the framing of the questions that were asked the expert that included the defendant or the reference to him as stepfather went beyond anything that Jensen and Hazeltine contemplates and constitutes reversible error. And I also submit that the use of the statements under the medical exceptions the medical diagnosis exception has not been argued to be harmless error by the state, as I understand their brief. We also have a situation where certainly information that was utilized, this double hearsay information, utilized by the nurse practitioner and the doctor in making their own determination. In this case, where the doctor, Levitt, never saw the child. So we would say that it is prejudicial.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have rebuttal time. Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller representing the state.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Mueller representing the plaintiff respondent, State of Wisconsin. Although this case presents three issues for this court to decide, it is evident from the court's questioning that the court seems to be most concerned with the first issue presented, and that is whether the trial court erroneously exercised its discretion when it admitted statements that the victim had made to her mother, her sister, and a police officer under the excited utterance exception to the hearsay rule. At first, the state, upon reading the defendant's brief, believed that the defense was asking this court to adopt a bright line rule based on the factors identified in Gerald L.C. However, it does not appear that that is exactly what the defense is arguing. Those factors identified in Gerald L.C. really were a distillation of cases decided by this court and the Court of Appeals, and the state certainly has no quarrel with the correctness of saying that in prior cases applying the excited utterance exception in child sexual assault cases, generally the child was under 10. The time of reporting between the assaultive incident and the incident itself was about a week, and that the child usually reported to his or her mother. The state has no problem with saying these are general factors. However, as the court in Gerald L.C. itself recognized, not one of these factors should be viewed as dispositive. Rather, they should merely be viewed as guidelines for a trial court to use in deciding whether a given statement qualifies as an excited utterance. And in this particular case, the factors that apply to the statements made by the victim, Jerry E., to each of these three people, her mom, her sister, and a police officer, should not be disqualified as excited utterances for several reasons. One of the reasons, which I think is really overlooked in the defense's brief, is that even though the trial court here did not make a factual finding that this girl was under the stress of excitement caused by the sexual assaults when she made these revelations, there's undisputed testimony that when she spoke to her mother and her sister and Officer Glau, she was definitely very upset, and this upset was directly related to the fact that Mr. Huntington had been repeatedly assaulting her for a very long period of time.
Well, let me ask you in terms of what if this were 5 years later and she was deeply upset? I mean, people can be upset five, six, seven, much longer. Somebody could describe the death of a parent years and years later and become very upset in recounting that. Does that necessarily mean that they are under the stress of the event?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. I think if you take a five-year period, the problem you would run into is that the court would have no way of knowing what other influences had worked upon the child's mind in the intervening 5 years. Just to give an example, if the child had gone through therapy that dealt in repressed memories or something, you wouldn't be able to know that perhaps the child's memory was really implanted by therapy.
What happened in the time frame between the incident and the statement critical to determination if a declarant is still under the stress of the event? As opposed to simply knowing that there's a known event and that later there's a statement by the declarant who gets upset and recounts something, isn't that something that a court ought to have to look at, is what's happening in the interim?
I think that's certainly one factor that the trial court should consider. And I think here, if you take the time period as being 2 weeks prior to August 19th, which is when the revelation to the mom and the sister and the officer occurred, a two-week period, you say, well, what was happening there? And critical in this case is the fact that shortly before the revelation occurred, the child became aware that her mother was planning a trip to Denver with her sister and would be gone as long as 2 weeks, at which time the child would be left with Mr. Huntington. So, I mean, that's a very important triggering event that would tend to show why did the revelation occur when it did. Okay. Yes, Your Honor?
Isn't it equally plausible that the child was upset and stressed when she talked to Mom, because she knew that she was lying.
No, I don't think that's a plausible interpretation.
Why is that?
Because...
And also, isn't it equally plausible that the triggering event of Mr. Huntington, she just simply didn't want to stay with Mr. Huntington for any number of reasons, not necessarily a sexual assault?
The reason I don't think either of those possibilities is really plausible based on this record is that the records show, based on the girl's testimony and testimony of other witnesses, that except for the fact that this revelation occurred, she had liked being with Mr. Huntington because he tended to shower her with a lot of material possessions that her mother really could not afford. So it was a very ambiguous or case of mixed emotions that this girl had. On the one hand, Mr. Huntington did a lot for her materially. He let her have friends over to his house. He took her places, things that her mom couldn't afford to do. And she explained that that was actually one of the reasons she found it so difficult to come forward.
It seems to me that the 2 weeks gave this child, the 2 weeks interval, and that's the best, gave this child ample opportunity to reflect, ample opportunity to corroborate, or to collaborate, I should say, somebody else, ample opportunity to be coached. And so again, I repeat, why is it not equally plausible that when she showed this stress at the time that she started talking about this, that it was due to the fact that she was saying something that wasn't true? The fact that Mr. Huntington gave her gifts doesn't impress me as being relevant on the question of what caused the stress.
But the way in which the revelation occurred also, she was spending the night at the home of a friend, and her mother received a phone call, the girl being totally hysterical, could hardly speak over the phone. And the mother...
Jerry?
Pardon me?
Who was hysterical over the phone?
I believe the daughter was. She got that Jerry E. was hysterical over the phone. The mother rushed over to the friend's house and took the girl home, whereupon she spilled out the story of what had been happening. While this was going on, the sister came in. She saw both of them crying. So Mr. Shire's hypothesis that the reason the girl might have been upset was because she saw her mother crying doesn't really wash here because...
What started the crying? What started the incident? Is that in the record?
It's not really clear. It appears
well,
that
isn't
she...
Isn't that pretty critical that she's crying and she calls her mother hysterical, reporting something that happened 2 weeks earlier to find out what it is that instigated that reaction when apparently, at least there's nothing in the record, that those 2 weeks were particularly eventful or that she was under stress during that time?
The best we can tell from the record is that when she was spending the night at the friend's house, she told the friend that this was happening. They don't identify who the friend is in the record. She told the friend that this was happening, that Mr. Huntington had been touching her, whereupon it's not clear whether the mother of the friend said, "You call your mom," or whether she just did it on her own. But the phone call was immediately made to her mother. It was late at night. The mother came, picked her up, and that's when the revelation occurred. It's also pretty clear that the timing was somewhat triggered, at least circumstantially, by the fact this girl knew she might have to spend a long period of time with the defendant.
Here's the problem I have with that argument. Every exception in the hearsay rule is founded in some inherent trustworthiness, that there's some trustworthiness. And as you go through each exception, the rules and all the treatises explain what the trustworthiness is. And the trustworthiness of this exception is that somebody experiences an extremely traumatic, stressful situation. Certainly sexual assault fits into that definition. And that you remain under the stress of that incident without time to reflect, and that you are so upset about it that what comes out of your mouth must be trustworthy because you don't have time to think about it, to talk to other people about it, to reflect upon it. And what we have here, well, we don't know what happened during those 2 weeks. I mean, I'm sort of critical of the lack of record because we don't know what happened 2 weeks. And the fact that you're telling me that what triggered it was that she was finding out she was going to have to spend 2 weeks with him, well, that's not describing the stress of the incident. It's the stress of the incident on top of something else, which is that she's going to have to spend 2 weeks with him, which doesn't seem to go to what the foundation of this exception is that you're so upset about the incident that what comes out of your mouth is just reaction to what you've just experienced in a traumatic event. And I understand the time frame can be long periods of time. People can be under stress for a long period of time, and the courts have expanded it for sexual assault. But without knowing what was going on for those 2 weeks, I don't know how a court can find, even in the exercise of discretion, that in fact the child was still under the stress of the event. other than we say all children, when they're sexually, allegedly sexually assaulted, are under the stress of the event for whatever period of time until they're reported.
I think one of the key factors this court and the Court of Appeals has identified is that there's an assumption that children will repress incidents like this. And that's why we make this sort of assumption that they remain under stress longer than, for example, if you had an adult witness a car accident, that certainly would be a startling event or condition, and you might make an excited utterance, but then you assume that it's sort of a one-time occurrence, and when a certain number of hours perhaps has passed, the person is no longer under the stress of excitement caused by witnessing this accident. In the case of children, and if you look at this court's decision in State versus Moats is a good example, there you've got a delay in reporting of at least, I think it's 10 days, because it was a week after the defendant, or it could be, it could be a delay of at most 10 days, it was unclear, from when the defendant left the home that he was sharing with the victim and her mother, and then there was a 2 or 3 day period when the mom had returned from the hospital. There was no indication in Moats that it was necessary for the state to establish this sort of foundation showing that within that 10-day period, this child was consistently under that same stress caused by the very discreet assaultive incident. It was simply a presumption. And I think in this situation, where you've got a sexual assault that's not just a discrete incident, but it's going on over a period of, if you take the child's trial testimony, it went on from late 1993 until August of 1994. And if you take the mother's testimony, the girl was really confused about what year this was, so it really went on from 92 until 94. You're talking about a very different kind of stress than is experienced by someone who witnesses a tragic car accident, for example. You're talking about a stress that is building. It's repetitive. It's reinforced every time the child has to be in the company of the perpetrator alone. You fear that the same thing that happened before is going to happen again. So certainly this period of stress is punctuated by periods when the child is doing everyday activities like going to school, sleeping, eating, and there is no evident stress. But that does not mean that this court or the Court of Appeals was wrong in cases like Padilla, where it said, we assume that the child is repressing this incident.
Let me ask you, are there any outer limits to a child who, for apparently the first time, reveals a sexual assault and is extremely upset, crying, and exhibits stress? Is there any limit in times at all that would render that inadmissible under this exception?
I think there probably would be periods, I would hesitate to put a bright line period and say, okay, 15 days, we're going to cut it off here, because you can think of examples like Mr. Shire's of someone going into a catatonic state and then suddenly remembering that he or she had been the victim of an assault. But I think, you know, this case is within the time frame that was held in Harris, where they went up to 15 days, where it was a younger child, but the revelation was made to a probation or parole officer. And I think it's close to Moats as well. But you look at all these different factors. And I also think that you have to distinguish between many of the reported cases where, first of all, the trial court never found or there was no factual foundation laid to show that there was actual stress. It was simply based on this assumption. You've got a 5-year-old. A couple days later, the 5-year-old is still going to be stressed out, even if the 5-year-old is acting normal.
Let me interrupt you just to change focus for a minute. Was it your reading of the transcript that the theory of the defense did not support the admissibility of these statements under prior consistent statement to rebut improper motive and influence or...
The reason I never argued that is I think that it would be contrary to State versus Peters, I think, is the controlling case there, where it's indicated that the prior statements have to predate the motive that the child would have.
So the improper motive here was attached to the initial statement.
Would have been. Although I don't really think that the defense really pressed this so-called motive very hard at all, because in its opening, the defendant basically said, we're going to be arguing that this girl made all these inconsistent statements in terms of the number of times the assault happened, the starting date, the ending date, and we think she's lying, but we don't know why. So they didn't really ascribe any particular motive. And so I don't think that a prior consistent statement exception
would... Could you get on to the other issues? I know that we spent a lot of time on the first one, but I think...
In fact, I have a question on that another issue, medical diagnosis or treatment. You want us to extend the exception for medical diagnosis and treatment to social workers. I think you cite some Eighth Circuit cases. Are you arguing that a social worker employed by a county department of health and social services or should have the exception applied to that position?
Yes. In fact, I think that statements made for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment can include statements that a patient makes to a family member who is then expected to turn over the...
Okay, now that's a different issue. You're talking about third-party reporting, which is another issue in this case with regard to medical diagnosis and treatment. I understand your argument to be vis-a-vis the clinical social worker Bell, I think is the name, but I might be wrong, that excited utterance doesn't apply to her testimony.
Correct.
Rather, what applies is medical diagnosis and treatment, because the child told her, a social worker, this for medical diagnosis or treatment. Never before in the state of Wisconsin have we applied that exception to a social worker. And I'm concerned about opening up this broad exception to all the people who hold social...
Just to clarify, it was Lori Carter Bell is the clinical social worker. However, and she's also the tribal counselor. Her education is in clinical social work. She did not testify at trial. So what it was is that the child was taken to the tribal counselor, Ms. Bell, first. And then Ms. Bell, after she took this medical history from the child, made a referral to Dr. Levitt and Nurse McCormick and repeated what the child had said. At the same time, the mother, as part of giving the history, also repeated what the child had said. And our position is that not only the child's statements to Lori Carter Bell, but also the repetition, both came under statements made for purposes of...
Those are two discrete issues. One is third-party reporting. Can someone other than the injured party make a statement for purposes of diagnosis and treatment and fall within the exception?
I guess I don't see them as being totally discreet, because if you had a situation, for example, where a child or any other declarant for that matter was relating their medical symptoms to a person who was not even trained in medicine, but the person, the declarant, knew that the reason the statements were being made was so this other intermediary could then talk to the doctor or the nurse, those initial statements, in the state's view, would qualify under the hearsay exception for statements made for purposes of medical diagnosis or treatment. And just to give you some examples, if you had a situation where the declarant didn't speak English, so the declarant was unable to speak to a doctor or a nurse, and the declarant then told someone who spoke the same language about his or her symptoms, that person, in the state's view, should be able to get on the stand and testify to those statements under the medical diagnosis exception.
I'm concerned about abuse. Let's take a custody case. And the mother, who's fighting for custody, then tells the doctor lies. That comes in under medical diagnosis or treatment, because ostensibly that's what the mother was trying to accomplish.
Right. I think how you take care of that is you have to look at the motive of the declarant and then the motive of the person who is relating the statements.
Well, how's the doctor? How's anyone going to know the motive necessarily? How are you going to read the mind? I mean, I had a case involving a owner of a building, and he had an employee up in the rafters, and the employee fell down, and the owner of the building called the doctor and said, boy, the guy had a seizure, and that's why he fell. But the employee thought the reason he fell was because an unsafe building and brought a suit against the employer. You know,
saying that he had a seizure indicates something that you would actually observe, and so that person would be able to be cross-examined about it. But I think that in most cases, you're going to know enough about the circumstances of the parties to see whether, in fact, there was some type of motive so that those statements really weren't made for that purpose, and the trial court can always disqualify them. But I think if you have an absolute rule that the statements can only be made, for example, in State versus Nelson, which is a decision by this court held that statements to a psychologist qualified. And quite honestly, I think nowadays, a lot of times clinical social workers really are sort of like poor people, psychologists or psychiatrists. People who are lower income and can't always afford to go see someone who's got a degree in psychiatry will be getting therapy or assistance from somebody who maybe doesn't have the same credentials. That was something the U.S. Supreme Court recently acknowledged in Jaffe versus Redmond, where they said the psychologist patient or the psychotherapist patient privilege extends to a social worker. And I think the same rationale should apply here. Just because Ms. Carter Bell was a social worker as opposed to a psychologist, I don't see as a reason for limiting application of the privilege. It was very clear that the reason Jerry was brought to her for a number of therapy sessions was to get help as a result of her being sexually assaulted.
Ms. Waller, are you also relying on the excited utterance in regard to that particular double hearsay situation?
Insofar as the child's mother related the child's statements to Nurse McCormick, the first level of hearsay there we're relying on is excited utterance. So obviously if this court rejects the state's initial argument that the child's statements were excited utterances, then that rationale would fall through because you have to satisfy both levels of hearsay. But the second level, again, is the medical diagnosis that the mother was giving the information to Nurse McCormick as part of the medical history.
And in regard to Ms. Bell, as I understand what you were saying, you're relying not on excited utterance and then medical diagnosis, but on medical diagnosis, then medical diagnosis.
Correct. So it's like a double medical diagnosis exception with respect to statements to Lori Carter Bell, which were then made to Nurse McCormick. That's correct.
I note that your brief doesn't have a section saying, I think everything the trial judge did was terrific, but that if there was error, it's all harmless.
That's right. And that was a decision made because when you've got three different allegations of error, your harmless argument would really be, well, if this was error but these two weren't, then we think it's harmless. If, you know, these two were error, and I guess the point I will concede is that if this court finds that all three of the evidentiary rulings are error, then I can't say that it's harmless. Okay. But if you're talking about one of them, for example, if you're saying that the child's out-of-court statements being admitted through the mom and the sister and the officer should not have occurred, then I feel comfortable saying that that would be harmless because the child was subjected to extensive cross-examination by the defense attorney regarding all these inconsistent statements, and they were actually used or tried to be used to the defense's benefit.
Well, but then you get one and a half errors because part of your medical diagnosis depends on
that.
Right. So now we're one and a half out of three. What about the testimony of Dr. Levitt? Is it Dr. Levitt?
That's correct. Dr. Carolyn Levitt gave testimony which the defendant says crossed the Hazeltine-Jensen line and which the state says did not. Primarily, the defense's view seems to be that because the prosecutor, when he asked questions of Dr. Levitt, put in as part of his factual scenario, like let's assume that the accused is a father figure or a familial figure. The defense thinks that that is a violation of Hazeltine and Jensen because it pretty much names the accuser. The state does not agree with that. Rather, it's an attempt to show why the child's behavior in this case was consistent, not just with being sexually assaulted, but with being assaulted by someone who's a member of the family. It's recognized that there are very different dynamics involved. When someone is assaulted by a stranger, and maybe this occurs one time, you don't have a fear that it's going to happen again, as opposed to a child who's assaulted repeatedly by, in this case, a stepfather. And you're going to have different kinds of delays in reporting. There'll be a lot of reasons why a child would be unwilling to identify her assailant as her stepfather as opposed to some stranger. So I think that the fact the prosecutor wove into his questioning the circumstance that the accused was a stepfather was not impermissible. And additionally, something that really I don't think Mr. Shire answers is the fact that Dr. Leavitt never even interviewed this child. So it's difficult to see how the jury could assume that her testimony was intended as a comment on the child's credibility. In Hazeltine and Jensen, you had a police officer in one case and I believe a psychologist, or not, I actually can't remember for sure if it was a psychologist or a school teacher in the other, who had interviewed the girl, and it was clear that they were giving an opinion on whether they thought the victims in those cases were being honest. That is not what occurred here at all. And the fact that Dr. Leavitt, when she began her answer, said, whenever child abuse is happening in the family, I don't think that was the same as saying, well, because Jerry was being assaulted by her stepfather, that would be impermissible. But just explaining to the jury that whenever you've got a situation of intrafamilial assault, you're always going to have difficulty with enumerating how many times it happened because you're with the person so often. You're going to have a hard time saying when it started and when it ended because you're not like an adult where you've got a specific date that something occurred. You know, you're a child and you don't tie it to an event, and plus it's going on for so long. That explains a lot more about the delayed reporting here, the unwillingness of the girl to come forward, and why kids in that position are more likely to be secretive about disclosing something than if you had a stranger assault. So I think it was really critical for Dr. Leavitt's testimony to have any assistance to the jury that it be couched in terms of whenever you've got sexual abuse happening within the confines of a family.
Ms. Muller, how did Dr. Leavitt describe child abuse accommodation syndrome? Did she give a definition to that or a framework to that?
I believe she was quoting from Dr. Roland Summit and saying basically you see a lot of different characteristics that don't necessarily occur across the board but that are common. And one of the things she mentioned was that when you've got a parent doing this, the child then experiences feelings of shame and thinks to herself, "Why? I should have been able to stop this, but I didn't." And I don't recall exactly what other characteristics Dr. Leavitt gave, but it was general statements as to what characteristics Dr. Roland Summit had identified in victims.
My understanding is that she was never asked, for instance, whether or not she believed the child or believed the child was telling the truth or anything of that nature. Is that
correct?
That's
exactly correct. She was never asked, well, do you think the child was a victim of a sexual assault? She was merely asked whether the behaviors that were manifested were consistent with other cases she had been involved with where the perpetrator or alleged perpetrator was a member of the family. So she was never asked, did you believe this girl or do you find her credible? And that's what distinguishes this case from Hazeltine and from Jensen.
Now let me ask you, Jerry E.'s mother testified, right?
That's correct.
And she testified as in the statements her daughter told her, and the theory is excited utterance, right?
Correct.
Right. Then, in addition, the state called a nurse to testify as to what Jerry's mother told her. Is that right?
Correct.
How was the mother cross-examined? It seems to me that what you've got is the mother testifying as to what the daughter said, and then you had another witness who testifies about what the mother said the daughter said. Was there some cross-examination of the mother that second statement was needed? I mean, it's like calling the same witness twice, once directly and once through another hearsay witness.
I think it was cumulative. I mean, in the sense that I think the district attorney was somewhat insecure about how much he needed to put on.
What's the difference between cumulative and piling on?
And what?
Piling on.
There's a fine line, I think.
That's which side's argument, right?
There's a fine line, but I think part of the reason it was repeated when Nurse McCormick testified was that she had to give the basis for her testimony. In other words, how did you treat the child? I talked to the mother. I took a statement from the mother, and then this is what she said.
Right,
I agree.
But that wasn't an issue, was it? I mean, there wasn't some question as to why she treated her that the state had to...
No, I agree. They didn't have to go into as much depth.
I mean, there's no relevance to the second witness testifying what the mother said, the daughter said, when the mother's already testified as to what the daughter said, is there?
For sure. Show consistency of statements.
Well, it does show that there's, more consistency. I mean, the statements that the girl gave were always consistent in terms of the general.
But does that show consistency? Did the mother testify consistently
with what the nurse said, the mother said? Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The mother said the daughter told me X, Y, and Z. Did the nurse say that the mother told her the same thing?
There was, I don't recall there being any, you know, any kind of major or glaring inconsistency. And it wasn't as if the defense was saying the mom was a liar. I don't think that really came up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mueller. Mr. Shire, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal, or thereabouts.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. With regard to the exception for medical diagnosis, I think that what we have in this particular situation, as the court has alluded to, is a double hearsay matter. But the reason we have a rule, and this is the Wisconsin rules of evidence, are patterned to a certain extent after the federal rules of evidence, is that when somebody goes to a physician, or in this state under Nelson, a psychologist, they are going with the sense that what they say is for the diagnosis of a condition and for treatment, and it's particularly trustworthy. In this particular situation, there has been no recognition of statements to a social worker as having similar guarantees of trustworthiness, nor has the state cited pervasive authority, which shows that would be the case. This is complicated by the situation where there are statements to third parties which come in for purposes of medical diagnosis as double hearsay. And part of the problem with this is, it seems to me that what this would encourage is going to third party, if this court would adopt the rationale the state has proposed, going to